Guilty times 10 today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. El Chapo Guzman is found guilty on all counts in a New York courtroom today. Some see the end of an era when drug cartel bosses control everything.
We're observing more sophisticated criminal structures, more fragmented, where everybody specializes in one of the segments of the supply chain.
Also, the worsening impact of Venezuela's crisis on people's lives.
You yourself can watch people on the streets eating from garbage at night.
And we continue our reporting from Hungary with a look at how the right-wing government there controls the news media.
They turned the public service broadcaster into state media, basically.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Guilty on all counts, the jury in the trial of Joaquin El Chapo Guzman returned their verdict today. He was accused of running the violent Sinaloa cartel, a gang that smuggled tons of drugs into the United States for years.
Well, I think it's a very good day. I think it's a good day for the end of impunity, the rule of law. It took a long time to get here.
That's reaction from author Sam Quiñones to the verdict. He's followed the illicit drug business for a long time. We'll hear more from him in a moment. For 11 weeks, El Chapo's trial served up jaw-dropping testimony about murders, bribes, corruption. One of Guzman's close aides accused former Mexican president Enrique Peña Nieto of taking a $100 million bribe from Guzman. Peña Nieto denies the claim. The prosecution rested on day 35 of the trial. The defense rested after a single witness testified for a half hour. The jury deliberated for 6 days, long enough that people who thought a guilty verdict should be a slam dunk started to wonder, could Mexico's most notorious drug lord be acquitted? But no, on all 10 counts, El Chapo is guilty. He could get life in prison. We'll find out at the end of June when he's sentenced. But does it make any impact on the illegal drug trade between the U.S. and Mexico? Guadalupe Correa Cabrera is a professor at George Mason University and an expert on international organized crime.
The El Chapo trial is a big blow. His leadership was important, of course, and this could lead to more factions and more fragmentation within the Sinaloa cartel. But in reality, these organizations and the leadership are not subject to just one man. So it really doesn't make a difference with regards to drug trafficking in Mexico.
Who's in charge of the Sinaloa cartel now, and what is their background?
Recently, the Sinaloa cartel leadership has been divided between El Mayo Zambada and sons of El Chapo Guzman. But it doesn't really matter who is leading the organization. The organization is going to be transforming itself depending on the opportunities. Of course, a leader means something. There are some initial violence. Another cartel has controlled some areas that at some point were controlled by the Sinaloa cartel. But in reality, drugs are smuggled by one group or the other one. That doesn't change. It's like a business. If you understand these organizations as business models without focus on the head of these groups, you will understand better what's going on. Because there's always a market. There's always demand. And we are focusing on the supply side, on the narco part, without understanding well how the markets operate.
So you're saying it's important that officials have removed a major player from the criminal enterprise, but you see these guilty verdicts on El Chapo Guzman as mostly symbolic?
Yeah, it's symbolic because probably this is the end of the times of the narco strategy. It's all about the figure. It's all about the spectacle. Recently, we're observing more sophisticated criminal structures where everybody specializes in one of the segments of the supply chain of drug trafficking from Mexico to the United States. The markets have become much more specialized. We now have fentanyl coming from China, and we have different types of drugs that are transported through the same routes. So we might be talking about more sophisticated enterprises that involve leadership at a different level, which is probably why this is just symbolic. This is the end of an era of drug trafficking in a traditional form.
Guadalupe Correa Cabrera is an expert on international organized crime. She's also a professor at George Mason University and a Wilson Center fellow. Stopping the flow of illegal drugs has been one of President Trump's main arguments for a wall on the southern border. And congressional leaders did include at least 55 miles of a new wall in their latest attempt at a funding compromise. But can walls really make a difference in stopping the drug trade? And just how bad is the drug problem on the border right now? Sam Quiñones is the author of Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic.
The southern border is the central channel through which virtually all of our drugs come nowadays, except for the fentanyl that comes from China in the mail and stuff that's made locally in the United States. I would say, you know, most of the drugs come through or from Mexico, but these drugs come through walls. They come through the border entries in Nogales and Juarez and in Tijuana and through walls through heavily guarded with the drug dogs and officers and walls themselves, all of that. I believe that a wall, and I'm not sure really what the idea is, but a wall length, the length of our border with Mexico is a horrible distraction. It distracts us from the way we really need to fight drug trafficking in an era of heroin and now of fentanyl, is through a deep attention to alliances, primarily with Mexico, forcing Mexico to man up in a sense, aware of our own participation in all this. And it also a wall that weds us to this idea that there's a one solution and we can all go it alone. It's an international problem. We need alliances, and a wall will not solve that.
Have you seen any studies on the impact of different anti-narcotics measures at the border, like a wall? Like, what does that actually do?
Look, the border crossings areas all have walls. In those areas, the price of crossing illegally as an illegal immigrant is now in the thousands of dollars. So the walls have done an amazing job of staunching illegal immigrant flows. What they have not done is done anything about the drug situation. And the drugs, meanwhile, as prices for crossing illegally have gone up, the prices for drugs have gone way down. We're now some of the cheapest heroin prices we've ever seen in our history. And that's some of the most potent heroin we've ever seen. Methamphetamine from Mexico is now being given away in many states that I've traveled to as a way of priming demand for meth among opiate users. So the prices for drugs are so low. They're historically low right now. And just as the prices for illegal crossing are stratospheric. And I think that says something about what walls are good for. They are good for staunching the flow of people. They fail miserably when it comes to staunching the flow of drugs.
Sam Quiñones, just to bring it back to El Chapo and the guilty verdicts today, do you think that's going to have any short or long-term effects on drugs coming into this country?
He was a major player, and it may have an effect on the functioning of the Sinaloa cartel because he was a major factor in that. But the thing is about drug trafficking in Mexico now, it's been the case for several years, is that it's been fragmenting daily almost. You read reports, yeah, some of these cartels have no idea who they are, where they're coming from. They come out of nowhere, they leave. I do, however, continue to believe that going after guys like this, taking them down, is a way of saying you are not immune from the law, and that allowing guys like Chapo to become part of the Forbes list of billionaires in the world is an outrage, and it cannot be allowed to stand. And so I think that is the benefit of it. What effect it has on the daily flow of drugs, I guess we're going to find out. It probably won't have a whole lot.
Sam Quiñones, the author of Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic, speaking with us from Los Angeles. Thanks very much, Sam.
My pleasure, Marco.
In the age of hyper-globalization, it seems that pretty much anything can be manufactured overseas and shipped to its destination. Okay, not anything. I mean, you couldn't construct a hotel or apartment building in China or Eastern Europe and send it to the U.S., right? Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
In the city of Newton, just outside of Boston, large boxes, 65 feet long, 13 feet across, dangle in the air from a 600-ton crane. They're being stacked on top of each other like Legos.
One box has the bedroom in, the other box has the living, dining, kitchen in.
Architect Arthur Klipfel is developing this 68-unit apartment complex. Klipfel also designed this modular, independent pieces fitted together to form a building. His company, Green Stacks, allows architects to choose from a library of more than 20 standardized boxes. Gwen Noyes is his wife and business partner.
The boxes can come with the kitchen cabinets, the flooring, all the bathroom fixtures, the prime coat of paint, the electrical that is all the electrical.
All that work was done 350 miles north in a factory in Quebec.
So they're working in a controlled environment. The factory is beautiful. They have year-round work, and they don't have to deal with the weather.
There aren't factories building modulars that can accommodate this apartment project nearby to Boston. And so the finished boxes are trucked down through Canada and the woods of Maine, then on to eastern Massachusetts. It costs a lot to transport those boxes. They can make some of that back-paying rural Canadian carpenter somewhat less than Boston area workers. The husband and wife architect team say the real cost savings to building in a factory in Canada is speed.
The fact that we could complete the project in 5 months less than all the other projects was really a key factor in our getting the winning the competition to do this building.
The couple sees factory-built modulars as an affordable, quick solution to housing shortages in Boston and cities across the globe. Their prefabricated designs are also built green, with insulation and energy-efficient heating and cooling built in. Modulars have been around since after World War II. But with improved technology and logistics, developers are taking the idea more seriously. Stephanie Robson is with the School of Hotel Administration at Cornell University.
It's absolutely a trend. In fact, I think it's going to be the way many hotels will be built going forward.
Robson points to a hip Dutch boutique hotel, Citizen M, that recently opened in New York. The rooms were constructed in Poland.
Building modular helps us to create a very constant quality of rooms.
Martin DeHuge is the project architect for Citizen M's hotels. He says the modular boxes are fitted with pretty much everything in Poland.
It could even include the mattress and the television.
And shipped around the world. Here's one limitation, though. Size.
And Citizen M has a very small bedroom. It's just the width of a bed. It really is a room within the size of a sea container.
Stop and visualize that for a second. You're spending the night in a shipping container, but with a bed, desk, and a bathroom. You have to climb off the foot of the bed. The sides touch the walls. Still, the rooms do look groovy and comfy, but they may not be for everyone. That's one major limitation with most modular buildings. Architects can't get that creative. Again, Stephanie Robson at Cornell.
The issue is the pieces themselves have to conform to whatever the transportation infrastructure can handle. But that doesn't mean that we won't see some innovations where we can build a larger guest room out of multiple components.
But this story isn't just about architectural innovation. It's also about jobs shifting across the globe. On the West Coast, some modular units are being constructed in China. Justin Widener is chief of staff at the Carpenters Union, which has 500,000 members in the U.S. and Canada.
Well, we know there's no stopping progress. Traditionally, this has been a trade and a career where you didn't have to worry about offshoring. But with modular construction, that's definitely a concern. However, it's coming.
And Widener also sees opportunity. More modulars means more construction. And the Carpenters Union has already forged relationships with some factories building modulars. Stephanie Robson says there's another way to look at the job story.
There will be lots of jobs. They'll just happen to be in factories instead of on job sites.
But the question is, where will those jobs be? Will they be in Poland or New England? For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Tens of thousands of Venezuelans went into the streets today to send a message to their embattled president, Nicolas Maduro. They want Maduro and the Venezuelan military that supports him to let the aid in. Desperately needed shipments of food and medicine have been stopped at the border with Colombia because Maduro says the aid is really just a ruse, something for the Americans to use to overthrow his government. The BBC's Orla Guerin sat down to speak with Maduro in the capital, Caracas. She asked him if he's confident that he has the support of his people, then why wouldn't he participate in a new election?
Listen, Orla, please, it's a war. I pray that God enlightens you. It's a political war of the United States Empire, of the interests of the extreme right that today is governing, of the Ku Klux Klan that rules the White House to take over Venezuela, and they have created a political, communications, and diplomatic strategy. They are warmongering in order to take over Venezuela.
Do you really think that Ku Klux Klan are ruling America?
I believe that the extremist sector of the white supremacists of the Ku Klux Klan is in charge of the United States. I believe it's a gang of extremists.
So is President Trump a white supremacist?
Lo es. He is, publicly and openly. He has encouraged the fascist tendencies, the neo-fascists and neo-Nazis within the United States, in Europe, in Latin America. It's an extremist tendency that hates the world. They hate us, they belittle us, because they only believe in their own interests and in the interests of the United States. So in this battle that we're leading for Venezuela, I tell you, it's a battle that goes beyond our country. I call upon the people of the world to wake up, open your eyes, to see that it is an aggression against a peaceful country, that Venezuela has many problems like many other countries in the world. And if you really want to help Venezuela, you have to support peace. Say no to the intervention.
Guerin pressed Maduro on why he's preventing that aid from entering the country. As I said earlier, we're talking food and medicine that's just sitting in warehouses across the Venezuelan border in Colombia.
Do we have problems? Yes. But Venezuela is not a country with hunger. Venezuela has very high levels of access to food, and the stereotype, the stigma of hunger they try to lay on us has only one objective, to present a humanitarian crisis that does not exist in Venezuela in order to push for intervention. So don't come here with a cheap show, a show of indignity, of humiliation, and offer $20 million in a food that is toxic and rotten.
But many working Venezuelans say their country desperately needs international aid. We reached out to 27-year-old Alejandro Guzman. Although Guzman has a law degree, he says he can't find clients because the economy is such a wreck. I asked him what he made of President Maduro's claim that Venezuela is not experiencing a real humanitarian crisis.
His script is to deny the crisis. It's just wrong. The Venezuelan people need that food because the actual fact is that people are starving on the streets. You yourself, I'm sure you can watch people on the streets eating from garbage at night.
Yeah.
And that's just in Caracas. Inside the Venezuela, if you travel to another state, you will see the worst phase of the humanitarian crisis.
Maduro also said the United States is insulting Venezuela's dignity by offering this food assistance. Do you see it as an insult?
No, because I understand that not only the United States, but more than 60 countries are trying to help the Venezuelans. And when you recognize that you need help, you are not throwing away your dignity. And that's humbling to the Venezuelan people.
That's Alejandro Guzman, a lawyer who spoke with me from Caracas. The opposition leader that Washington supports in all of this is Juan Guaido. The U.S. and most other Western governments recognize Guaido as the legitimate interim president of Venezuela. He spoke to protesters today, promising them that those humanitarian aid shipments would enter the country on February 23rd. Without a doubt, Venezuela's economy is in rough shape. But Tamir Porras Ponce León says outside aid is a trap. Like many middle-class Venezuelans, he has left the country. He now lives in Paris. He's also Maduro's former chief of staff.
We can imagine the crisis getting deeper, probably the government collapsing. But what about the day after? What about the military of Venezuela? What about the divisions within the military? What I am concerned is to have a stable and democratic country the day after. And that requires not provoking each other, political dialogue and understanding.
I mean, a democratic solution obviously is preferable, but we've spoken with so many Venezuelan opposition politicians and opposition voices in recent days, and they describe a government that's clinging to power using coercion and proceeds from corruption. I mean, that is the reality they're living day to day. It's hard to argue with that, isn't it?
Do they have a plan to guarantee that this country remains stable and democratic the day after? Do they guarantee that they will not allow, for instance, the U.S. government or the U.S. troops to enter Venezuela? Do they have a plan to deal with the Venezuelan military?
One of the things that has been said by the opposition very clearly is that there will be new elections. That is part of their plan.
And what guarantees that the departure of Maduro doesn't create a civil war, for instance? The reality of Venezuela is that it is a very polarized country. It is totally unrealistic or irresponsible to think or to assume that there are all the guarantees for Venezuela to be in a peaceful situation. In order to be an election, you have to agree on the terms of that election. When will the election be held? Who can be allowed to run for those elections? And that's exactly the problem. Saying there will be elections is assuming that the problem is solved before even addressing it.
I mean, you say it's polarized, but it's really only polarized if Chavismo is still a legitimate movement. And there are so many people who have peeled away from Chavismo.
Absolutely. But wishing for the best is not a strategy. The people who assume that shouldn't Mr. Maduro leave, I say, okay, so who can convince him of that? Shouldn't the Chavismo, you know, surrender power? Well, why not? But they're not doing it. So again, this is exactly the problem that needs to be tackled. You have two ways of tackling it, finding a way of getting out of the crisis politically or risk a conflict. That's the part that I believe some of the members of the opposition seem to be missing in this moment.
How worried are you by the prospect of civil conflict of some sort?
Extremely worried. That is why I keep warning about that risk. Absolutely. It's highly likely. There is threats coming from the U.S. administration saying Mr. Maduro must comply in a peaceful manner or else there is always a military option on the table. That would be catastrophic for the country. A second way that can happen is also imagine the Venezuelan military splitting, you know, between pro-Guaido, pro-Maduro, or pro-whatever. That is an extremely risky situation that can lead the country to a civil conflict instead of overcoming in a peaceful, civilized way the current crisis.
Tamir Porras Ponce León was chief of staff to Nicolas Maduro from 2007 to 2013. He's now a visiting professor at Sciences Po in Paris. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, how Hungary's right-wing government controls the media and more.
The government of Hungary has really turned into a police state. They can surveil everything everyone does. So if you start giving money to government-critical news media, the next thing you know, they might come after you.
Independent media hijacked in Hungary, just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In a healthy democracy, there is a natural tension between government and the news media. But in Hungary these days, there's not so much of that tension. And that's the way the country's right-wing Prime Minister Viktor Orban likes it. In 2010, a new law gave his government direct control of the media and allowed it to levy fines on outlets for reporting it considers imbalanced or insulting. Since then, coverage of Orban and his policies has been largely complimentary, and there are fewer and fewer critical voices. So what went wrong in a country where a free press flourished after the end of communism? Here's The World's Orla Barry.
Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude. No, I'm not going to give you a question. I'm not going to give you a question. You are fake news.
President Trump isn't the only person who uses those words. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban likes to use the phrase with reporters too. That's a fake news factory, Orban says. I won't speak to you. It's not the only similarity between the two countries, but in Hungary, press freedom is under much greater attack. The watchdog group Reporters Without Borders puts Hungary in 73rd place on its press freedom index. That's a drop of 50 places in just 8 years, below both Haiti and El Salvador. Pauline Adas-Mivel is from Reporters Without Borders.
Year after year, since Viktor Orban came back to power, the media freedom has been restricted and the level of freedom of press has shortened. I think Hungary is one of the countries that has really paved the way to such a situation that we see now in Central Europe.
For weeks now, people have been taking to the streets of Budapest in protest at several government policies.
No, no,
This video of the demonstrations went viral when opposition politicians were thrown out of the offices of the national public broadcaster MTV.
In Budapest last night, they were on the march. Pictures shared by social media as national TV won't cover the protests.
Yes, that's right. This protest and many others were never shown on the national public broadcaster. Perhaps it's not surprising that a national broadcaster, which is openly pro-government, would shy away from reporting on anti-government demonstrations. In Hungary, however, an increasing number of news outlets have come under the influence of Viktor Orban's party. Take, for example, the popular news site Origo. The website was once an independent media outlet, critical of the government and owned by Hungary's main telecom company.
I spent more than 10 years there for a long time. It was a really good place to do journalism. We had complete freedom in reporting about politics or doing investigations.
This is András Pétho, one of Origo's former senior reporters.
But around 2013-14, we started to feel that we were coming under pressure from our own management. They came to us with very unusual requests not to pursue certain stories. Later, they wanted to remove stories from the website. We always said no to these requests, but as the tension grew, the editor-in-chief was dismissed, forced out of his job, and then it was because of a story that I did, so I felt that I had no option but to resign.
And what was that story?
It was a very good story, but a simple story. It was a story about the unusually high hotel expenses of senior government officials.
The details of why and how Origo changed direction are murky. But by 2015, the telecom company had sold the website to the family of Viktor Orban's former finance minister. Today, it's the second most popular news site in Hungary, and it's openly pro-government. Éva Bognár, a media researcher at the Central European University in Budapest, says the Orbán government is regulating the news media in many new ways.
These include the infamous media laws that were introduced back in 2010. They turned the public service broadcaster into state media, basically. And then there were other means. Through ownership, they started buying out media through people that have close ties to the government.
While independent news sites do exist in Hungary, they struggle financially. Many journalists tell me that companies are nervous to be seen advertising with independent media outlets for fear it may affect their business. I put the point to Gergely Berzi, a pro-government political analyst.
I think there is no real reason why anybody could not finance or at least support these news outlets in Hungary. The fact that they don't choose to, that's a different question. It could be for business reasons as well as for their own personal political views.
It's hard to see how things can improve for independent media in Hungary. The European Union is monitoring the situation, but it's not clear that it can take any real punitive action. Change may have to come from the ground up. András Pétho, formerly of the news website Origo and now co-founder of an investigative site, believes the answer lies with the public.
More and more news outlets are realizing that one way out of these problems is turning towards the audience. That can be a financial solution and solve the trust issues. This community has been growing, so I mean that gives us some cause for optimism.
Optimism that'll be tested many times in the coming years as Hungarians decide whether or not they want their news media to hold Viktor Orban's government to account. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Budapest.
So will Hungarians push back against their leader's tight grip on the media? Kim Lane Shepley teaches international affairs at Princeton and focuses on Hungary.
First of all, it's not so clear to me that there are enough Hungarians to support the kind of news gathering that they need. And second of all, the government of Hungary has really turned into a police state. They can surveil everything everyone does, and everyone knows it. So if you start giving money to government-critical news media, the next thing you know, they might come after you.
So when you say not enough Hungarians would be able to support that, we're talking paying for news, right?
Paying for news, absolutely. So one of the problems is that the Orbán government has been so tough
on the kind of audience that would want independent news, that many, many people have left the country. So one recent estimate said that out of the 10 million people in Hungary, something like 1 million have left since 2007.
Wow.
Now, it's really hard to know because a lot of people have one foot there, one foot out. But for people who speak languages and who travel, the Hungarian media isn't really where they're getting their news from. And so that group isn't so likely to support the independent media in Hungary. And for the people who are stuck in the country and who are living solely in a Hungarian language space, it's very difficult for that group to actually support independent news as well. Now, it's happening. It's happening much more than I thought it would. But when you have a kind of, you have a situation where the government is just blanketing the country with its own version of the news, having these other versions also then starts to look somewhat suspicious.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in Budapest yesterday. Did he address any of these concerns about the media and democracy there?
Well, it used to be the case that when high-level government officials from the U.S. would go to Hungary, this was on the top of their list of things to raise. But under the Trump administration, Secretary Pompeo has been much more interested in the foreign relations of other countries than in their domestic affairs. So Mr. Pompeo met with some people from the civil sector in Hungary. This was not a high-profile part of his visit, and his public comments didn't really focus on it. And in fact, whenever someone from the U.S. government is asked about the internal affairs of any country, they usually say something like, it's none of our business. And I think that was very much Pompeo's message yesterday.
You've studied Hungary for 30 years. What do you find most fascinating about the country?
Well, Hungary is I always want to say it's a country of geniuses, and it's a beautiful place, and the culture is very rich, very deep. The people are amazing. But what I find really depressing is that what we're seeing now is the reemergence of so many structures that look exactly like the kinds of structures of control that were present in the communist time. Many of my friends who lived through the 70s and the 80s before the wall came down say that Hungary is worse off now than it was then. And they've lived through both times, so they have a way of understanding it. And this is at a moment when Hungary is touted as a member of the European Union, a member of NATO, one of the democracies in something called the Community of Democracies. And yet it's fallen so quickly. It's not because Hungarians have never gotten over communism. It's because they've literally been captured by an autocrat who knows how to get elected and then change the laws to make it impossible for anyone to ever get him out of power. And it's a new kind of model about how autocrats operate now. And I don't think the world has yet figured out how to rein these guys in.
Hungary expert Kim Lane Shepley, professor at Princeton University. Thank you very much, Kim.
Thank you very much.
As Washington found its way toward avoiding a second government shutdown today, hundreds of people were protesting in front of the White House over immigration.
What do we want? When do we want it? What do we want?
Immigrants demonstrating with chants of permanent residency now. They're immigrants with a certain status known as TPS, or temporary protected status. It gives them the right to live and work in the U.S. while their home countries recover from war or natural disaster. But in some cases, that recovery has taken years, even decades. Right now, there's more than 300,000 people with TPS. In the years that they've lived in the U.S., they've had kids who are American citizens. And every 18 months, TPS recipients reapply and go through a security check. Now they want permanent residency, and they feel like they've earned it. The urgency is that the Trump administration wants to tighten immigration and asylum laws, and it's ended TPS designation for El Salvador, Haiti, Honduras, Nepal, Nicaragua, and Sudan. That's six of the 10 countries in the TPS program. Jose Palma is the head organizer for the National TPS Alliance. He joins us from College Park, Maryland. Tell me a little bit about yourself, Jose. When did you come to the U.S.? When did you get TPS status?
So I came from El Salvador to Massachusetts back in 1998. I came looking for a dream of higher education, and that's what I have been doing in my last 21 years. At the same time, I have been also supporting my family of four. I have four U.S. citizen kids, and also supporting my family in El Salvador. And I have been protected for TPS for the last 18 years since we got TPS back in 2001 after the big earthquake that destroyed El Salvador.
I mean, the concerns about TPS, it's not just about you, Jose. It's also about your kids and now I gather your nephew who came to the U.S. more recently, right?
Yes, yes. Sometimes when we talk about TPS, we talk about specific number of people protected by TPS. But in reality, if something were to happen with us, it will affect not only the person with TPS, but the family that depend, like our own kids. There are U.S. citizens, but they are also concerned about what's going to happen. Like, for example, my son, Kevin, he want to be a cardiologist. He's a senior in high school, and right now he's applying to college. Mm. So he's a little concerned about that. I don't know what's going to happen with you. Like, should I put your name in my application or should I not? Like, my family in El Salvador, I send money to El Salvador every month in order to support my mom and some of the family members. So things like that sometimes are not considered when we are talking about a number of how many people have TPS.
I mean, the uncertainty of the economic future, the possible deportation, those are very real concerns for you and your kids. I mean, what kind of conversations are you and other parents having with your kids about your TPS status? I mean, what are you telling them?
At the beginning, when everything was happening with TPS, we thought this is something that the adults will live with. Kids, you guys continue focusing on school. But the reality is, like, they know what's going on and they are worried about what's going on. So what we say is, like, this is a family issue. So if you guys want to join and do something, let's do it. My son, mm-hmm. who has been playing soccer in school, now he doesn't have time for that. He's focusing on how can he support what we are doing to achieve permanent residency, because they know their future is also in the line if we lose TPS.
Jose, this is obviously not a normal time for this country, especially for immigration in this country. But when it comes to temporary protected status, I mean, how do you respond to people who say TPS is supposed to be temporary? And El Salvador has recovered largely from the earthquake in 2001. Why keep renewing TPS?
I think that people usually come to that conclusion when they don't really understand the places where we come from. Even though in paper it says temporary, the reality is that people have been renewing TPS for the last 20 years. How can somebody say it's temporary when it has been giving you the opportunity to live more than half of your life in a specific place? And now it's not only affecting that specific person, but the rest of the community and kids who have been born during that period of time. And the other thing is, like, it is true that the temporary protective status was given because of, for El Salvador, for the big earthquake. But the reality is that the country never recuperated from the earthquake and also some other things that have been happening in the country. And that's why so many administrations has been renewing TPS, because other conditions in the country continue not being safe for the community in the United States to go back.
Jose Palma, the head organizer for the National TPS Alliance, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for giving me a chance. Thank you.
The political arguments over immigration can overshadow more mundane challenges. For kids, that can be the teasing they face over the languages they speak. Reporter Zadie Stavely met one teacher who's trying to do something about that.
We will do an activity.
In her ethnic studies class at Castlemont High School in Oakland, California, Acacia Woods-Chan teaches students who have only been in the U.S. for a little while, a few months or a year. Some of them are from Yemen. Many come from countries in Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. At home, they speak Spanish, Arabic, and Mam, a Mayan language from Guatemala. Last year, Woods-Chan noticed something disturbing.
A number of the Spanish-speaking students, primarily, would be making fun of the Mam language and be making fun of the Arabic language.
Woods-Chan believes her students' fluency in another language is an asset, something that could even help them get a better job after high school or college. Also, teaching about identity, for her, is personal. She's African-American and Chinese-American. Her mother, who was born in the U.S. but spoke Cantonese at home, told her that when she was in kindergarten and still learning English, her teacher mocked her in front of the class. The little girl had a stomachache, but she didn't know the word for it. So she raised her hand.
And so she was like, I have a stomach. And she's like doubled over in pain. Her face is wrinkled and wrenched and just looking wretched. And the teacher's like, yes, of course you have a stomach.
That interaction was scarring for her mom. Woods-Chan keeps it close to her heart. She wants to be the opposite kind of teacher, one who would make an effort to understand. So when she saw her students making fun of each other's languages, she started asking them to take turns teaching a little bit of their home language each day. Students taught their peers how to count from 1 to 10, how to introduce themselves, and how to say basic phrases.
In English, what is your name?
En español, ¿cómo te llamas?
Tomam titbi.
Bilarabiya, ma huwa ismo.
Then they recorded themselves saying those phrases in short video clips, like this one, where the kids share how to say cool.
En español, chido, chido.
En mam, mejor, mejor.
En Arabic, gamil, gamil.
Woodchan says in her classroom it made a huge difference. Seeing words in their own languages written on the whiteboard and spoken in the video clips helped students with confidence.
And then some of my other students that were not in my advisory would come in and be like, hey, that's mom. I speak mom. That's mom.
Woodchan is not alone in her conviction. Displaying home languages in the classroom and using the languages in lessons is highlighted as a best practice for newcomer students by researchers at the City University of New York. They say treating the students as experts in their home languages can help them succeed.
Bueno, pues feliz. Con más ánimo.
15-year-old Wilfido from Guatemala says the project made him happy.
Porque todos quisieron aprender, mam.
Because everyone wanted to learn mom. He says he also learned a little bit of Arabic.
Bueno, solo una palabra.
How his friends told him to say hi.
Solo jala, jala.
Wilfido now wants to be an interpreter.
From the beginning of doing mom to the end of the year, you could see a huge shift in the way that not only the mom-speaking students regarded the importance of learning mom and of just having it visible, but then in the way that the other students received it as well.
17-year-old Orlando from El Salvador says he never knew Arabic or mom even existed before he came to the U.S. and heard his classmates talk.
No, yo no ponía a pensar y qué dirán.
Orlando says he had no idea what they were saying. He enjoyed learning a bit of the other languages, and he thinks it would be good for all classes to teach a little of home languages. When students first get here, he says, they think, no one talks like me. I'm the only one. And they feel alone. This way, they won't feel so bad. Woodschan hopes her school will use the videos as part of an orientation for students and families to help build a sense of respect and understanding among all students, newcomer and U.S.-born alike. For the world, Zadie Stavely in Oakland, California.
That story was reported with support from the Education Writers Association. Zadie also recorded it in Spanish. Listen at theworld.org. Finally today, we want to remember a sports hero, maybe not someone most of us Americans are familiar with, but for soccer fans in England, a major hero. His name is Gordon Banks, a goalkeeper. He was a member of the England national soccer team that won the World Cup in 1966, but he may be best remembered for making what's known as the world's greatest save. Our resident soccer nut, William Troop, takes us back to that moment.
We're talking summer of 1970. I was 5 years old. I was living in Mexico City, and the World Cup was in Mexico.
Right away!
This is very exciting. This was a matchup between the reigning champions of the world. England had won the World Cup 4 years before that.
England will have to face themselves in this heat.
And the team that everybody thought was the best team in the world, Brazil. And that Brazil team had a lot of famous stars on it. But the secret weapon was a certain guy called Pelé. So Pelé is probably the best soccer player there ever was. No offense to current stars. And in that game, he was up against one of the best goalkeepers there ever was, named Gordon Banks.
Put it in. Picking up the pace now, putting some pressure, real hard pressure.
There's this moment in the game. It's still 0-0. Nobody scored yet. A Brazilian player takes the ball around midfield, and he sprints down the side of the field. And then he kicks the ball to a spot right in front of the English goal. And standing right there is Pelé. He's waiting for the ball, and it's coming right to his head, so he hits the ball with his head. And the ball looks like it's going in, but Gordon Banks is standing on the other side of the goal, and he's starting to scramble across, and this is how Gordon Banks later remembered what was going through his head at the moment.
If I dive across here now, straight across here, I wouldn't be able to get it because it's going to bounce about a yard just in front of me dive. So now I know that I've got to get across there quickly at the same time.
Pelé also remembers that moment really clearly.
After I had the ball,
I already jumped to say go. Then I looked there. I did go.
And actually, everyone, not just Pele, thinks it's going in. But Banks dives slightly backwards and really low where the ball is going in. And he manages to hit the ball with his outstretched hand.
What a save!
Honest to God, I thought it was a goal. Now I'm breaking my fall. I don't know where it's gone. I hit the floor, and I now see the ball bounce behind the goal. And I said to myself, Banksy, you're lucky.
And so that is what became known as the world's greatest save.
The world's William Troop. Gordon Banks died today at the age of 81. Pelé posted a message on Facebook addressed to his one-time opponent. He wrote, "You were a goalkeeper with magic, but you were also so much more." Well, that's some respect there. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back tomorrow.